Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening. And welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s. Tonight, we're talking about debt. Young people today are facing stagnating incomes, mounting credit card debt, never-ending student loan payments, and extremely high housing costs. You could be the first generation, and I fervently hope not, but you could be the first generation in nearly a century that will not surpass or even equal your parents' standard of living. Our panel is here to tell us what we may or may not be doing right already and what we should be doing differently. Erica Sandberg is the Financial Education and Communications Advisor for Consumer Credit Counseling Service of San Francisco. She is a certified credit counselor and a member of the Financial Planning Association of San Francisco. Erica is a nationally known credit and money management expert with more than a decade of experience. Marjorie Jellin is a communications associate at the Public Policy Institute of California. She is also a graduate of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Like many of us here, she is in the throes of beating down her debt burden, so we'll have to hear that story. Ramit Sethi is a recent Stanford graduate, a blogger, and an entrepreneur. His blog, IWillTeachYouToBeRich.com, and a book out soon of the same name, is a personal finance site for college students and recent college grads. And David Robinson is a senior lecturer at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. He teaches a personal finance course for graduate and undergraduate students that provides an overview of personal planning within the context of the U.S. financial system and financial services. He also has a weekly column in the San Francisco Chronicle. Please welcome our panel. Well, you all look fresh, ready to go. I hope you are. What do you think, Erica, are the biggest problems? Growing student debt, not understanding how to use a credit card, not understanding the budget game, or is it that life just happens? I mean, you have experience in consumer credit counseling. What do you think the problems are?
Which is a ridiculous amount of access to credit card debt. It's just easier than ever to get a credit card, to have these huge credit lines, and everybody wants to give you plastic. And it's extremely difficult to say no. So, I mean, really the answer is, if you have the access, you're going to use it. It's just too hard to turn your back on it.
Marjorie, having been a student and digging yourself out of a mountain of debt, is she right?
She's absolutely right. I mean, I knew the amount of debt I was going to have when I graduated, yet I chose, despite all that, to have credit cards and use them while I was in school, so that by the time I was done, not only am I paying on my student loans, I'm also paying credit card debt. And the amount that I've accumulated is astronomical, but it's more manageable now.
All right. Does anyone else have a particular point to make on that question? No? Okay. Education is said to be the cornerstone of social mobility. In fact, most employers require college. We're in an information age now. But at the same time, grants for tuition have dwindled. Now 70% of financial aid for education is in the form of loans. Tuition has tripled since 1980. College students graduate on average with $20,000 in debt, grad students with $45,000 in debt. Marjorie, is a college education still worth it?
I would say yes, just because of some of the experiences I had, the people I meet, the people I'm still in contact with. I just graduated from grad school a couple of years ago. I've yet to see the rewards of that, but I cannot say that it's not worth it. But the burden, I will be paying the burden for the next 20 to 30 years.
Ramit, your recent graduate, is a college education worth it?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. I think, first of all, that there are non-financial aspects that make it really useful. So just the educational factor of being able to communicate and understand deeper issues. But in terms of the finance, that's a very real burden. I mean, I have a friend who got herself into about $15,000 of debt by the time she graduated. And she's a very, very smart girl. She works in finance, actually. And she keeps a more detailed budget than you can imagine. So I asked her, how'd you get into debt? And she said, I went to college as if I wasn't a college student. So she would, you know, she would go out Friday, Saturday nights, a couple $100, Cabo for spring break, and it adds up. I think looking ahead and figuring out ways to get college students to think ahead, so that she tells me all the time, I'm going to be paying off my college loans and my student debt and credit card debt until she's 45. So getting them to think ahead, that's the challenge.
David, you interact with college students all the time. Do you think they are getting the value for their money?
I sure hope so at Berkeley, yes. I think a college education is a great thing. I personally did it about five times, like most academics, and then I never got a real job. I never left. Yes, undergraduate education pays off very well, but I'll tell you seriously that anybody who is in my office talking about going to graduate school and getting a PhD, I tell them truthfully what I believe to be the fact. A PhD is the only degree I know where you can actually get paid less 5 years later after you've completed the degree. And I encourage people not to do the PhD.
Ramit said something about preparing for the future, and you were talking about the students that you meet. David, do you think that personal finance classes should be taught in high school and college formally?
For all of information, I'm a great believer in just-in-time information, and taking somebody age 14 and teaching them about nuances of life insurance is a really bad idea. But as you know, we started our personal finance course this year. It's the first time we've offered it, and we literally had people sitting in the aisles. There was a great demand for it. And so by the time people get to college, where indeed they are managing a lot of debt and consumer debt and are anticipating getting good incomes, they're ready and willing to hear it. And
but so do
I,
you
I think
some
the timing's right there.
Very basic education could be given earlier?
Oh, of course, yes. Yes, but
what do you think those classes should include? If you did it earlier, why don't you compare and contrast what you would teach in high school and what you would teach in college?
Well, simply to teach people that a loan is something that has to be paid back. And I can give you an example. I've run several trips into China, and they're quite expensive. And some students have to go negotiate with their parents. Other students are able to charge it to financial aid. And when a student is taking $5,000-$7,000 worth of financial aid to go on a discretionary trip to China, I have asked them, may I ask, is this grants and scholarships, or is it loans? Now, what is most surprising to me is the number of students who say, I'm not really sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Then I have a question. When it comes down to being loans, I say, well, have you had the chat with mom and dad? Is this their loans or your loans? Who is going to pay it back? And there is a deafening silence.
Okay, well, let's break a little bit of that silence right now. Ramit, in reading the comments on your blog, I'm struck by how practical some people are and how clueless others are. So my question to you is, would classes help?
That's a tough one. I think that a lot of people look back and they say, one thing that I wish I had done in college was learn how to manage my money, which of course is not true, because when we're in college, we don't care at all about it. And so it's a little bit of retrospective labeling. And what I think is the challenge is to not have, you know, school administrators and other folks who are putting on this type of education to put on the same old boring, bring in some old white guy who's going to talk about inflation, and then they can
David, you're
clean.
Accepted.
Oh, yeah. Exception.
He's not speaking about that.
But that happens so often, and I've been at those talks, and you can see somebody coming in and talking about bonds, which are virtually irrelevant for people at our age, and people's eyes are just glazing over, and they're talking about things like, here's how you roll over your IRA. You know, who cares? We want to know two things. We want to know, what am I spending my money on? And how do I spend it on the things that I want to, whether that is going out to restaurants with friends or an iPod or paying down my debt? And so I think that education works, but not in the sense that it's been done. We've tried this for years, mm-hmm. and it's not working. We see that from the debt we have. And I think what works is understanding how young people are talking. We read blogs. We talk on social networks. I get YouTube videos sent to me every day, and I talk to my friends. And yet, none of those, except for blogs, have personal finance built into them. No one has gone there.
I would take one issue with you, however, and that is people of a certain class use blogs.
Absolutely.
I am trying to educate a different group of people, Spanish-speaking people. It's a very fast-growing audience for blogs and the Internet, but it is still a small minority. And so I agree with you completely about the need to teach it in a creative way, making a budget more a game, a stress reliever, if you will, than making it, you know, a way of keeping records. But I'm not so sure that that's the only avenue, especially with the younger people. Marjorie, you got into trouble in college. You're talking about doing some of the things David pointed out. What kind of thing would help you class-wise, you know, having a class? Would it be the Internet and interactive, or would it be more directly hands-on?
I'm of the same mind as Ramit. I use the Internet more. I've started to read three financial blogs daily. One of them is, you know, Get Rich Slowly. The other is The Simple Dollar. And I'm a big fan of those. It's a good motivator and a way to stay focused. It's something that I do, and I find that more useful. A class would be helpful, especially at the undergraduate level.
Uh-huh.
Class on whether it makes financial sense to continue on to graduate school. You know, things like that.
I was actually thinking of even simpler things. Erica, I mean, you must see where the gaps are. Where are the gaps in people's financial education that get them into the most trouble?
Well, I think it's kind of funny when you start thinking, well, you know, should they have a class in high school, a class in college? I have a four-year-old, teaching her about money right now.
Thank you.
But I mean, it doesn't take much. It's just a simple dialogue. You start talking about what a quarter is and about what a box of cereal costs, and it just becomes an integral part of your conversation with your, you know, with your children. So it's got to start there. And unfortunately, if parents don't know, they're going to have a real hard time passing that on. So where do you start? There's a wonderful organization called Jumpstart.org, and what they're trying to do is incorporate financial literacy and education components into kindergarten, you know, second grade, throwing it into the mathematical models, you know, to, you know, whatever it is. Just starting there, because if parents don't know, someone's got to teach it.
A friend of mine's daughter, I think she was 6 or 7 years old, wanted a pair of very expensive tennis shoes and just wouldn't give up. Nag, nag, nag. And finally her mother sat down and said, look, let me show you what I make an hour. And let me show you how many hours it would take me to work without buying food or paying rent or any of the things in order to buy you those tennis shoes. She got it. Mm-hmm. And then her daughter became a partner mm-hmm. with her. And she understood that no wasn't because mom was being angry with her or disappointed in her or just being nasty. No was mm-hmm. no because mom couldn't do it. And she understood that, and it was very helpful. Marjorie, would that have made a difference to you at all, that kind of education? Did you have that kind of education at home?
Absolutely not. Both my parents were immigrants. They were working two jobs. We were barely making ends meet with five children in the house. And how can they tell me anything? It would have to come from an outside source.
So do you still believe that it would be useful to have financial education in the high schools or not?
Absolutely.
You do. And Ramit?
Yeah, I do, in a form that resonates with students.
Very good point. David, if you had students who had some financial education in high school, would your job be easier?
Yes, but with the issue that there's people are ready to hear things at certain times.
Very good point. Very good point. You know, I just want to take a little sidestep here. Ramit, I'm just totally thrilled with the title of your blog, I Will Teach You to Be Rich.com. You're under 25. Where do you get the street creds to teach others to be rich?
I know the name of that site sounds like a big fat scam, but it's the opposite of that. What I talk about on my blog is long-term investing, how to think about money, investor psychology, investing for the long term. So it's funny, I get that question, but I only get it from companies and older people.
And journalists.
And journalists, yes. I think.
And old journalists.
I think there's a simple answer to that, and there's a more nuanced answer. You know, the simple answer is that I work in technology, and you know, technology has money to pay people who are performing that kind of stuff. But I think the more nuanced answer is that what I ask my readers on my site is, what does rich mean to you? And so a lot of times, rich means driving a Mercedes and, you know, traveling around the world. And that's perfectly acceptable if that's what people want to do, if that's what rich means. What I've found, at least for me, and certainly for a lot of my readers, is that that's not the case. Yes, some of them want great, nice things in life, and they want a new, you know, Armani jacket or something, fine. But it means different things to different people. Some people want to start a scholarship. Some people want to be able to live in a certain area. Some people want to be able to do a job that they want to do. So for me, you know, where do I get the credibility? It's having been able to turn down a number of great offers to work at a company that I wanted to, that I co-founded with a couple guys, and to do that, you know, and then to the way that the credibility, I think credibility is inferred. So I asked my readers, I said, tell me something you've done as a result of this site. 800 responses. People are saying, good. I opened a Roth IRA. I talked to my dad about his retirement. I think that's where you get it from.
Great. Thank you. Erica, your book, Expecting Money, The Essential Financial Plan for New and Growing Families, is due out this fall. A lot of people in their 20s and 30s want to start families. And the question is, where should they be financially to do that?
Without any debt at all.
Whoa.
No,
Does that ever happen?
Oh, yeah. There's people out there who don't have debt. And I say that sort of, you know, comically. But the thing is that you can't afford to have debt. Debt is a luxury. And you think about it that way. It's pretty difficult to make ends meet, particularly here in the Bay Area. And if you already have money promised to, you know, your credit card company and you're being charged high interest rates, you're already living behind. And having a child is so phenomenally expensive that you have, if you haven't done it yet, don't know it yet. And that's why the book is what it is. Because on average, you're looking at $10,000 in the first year of having a child. And if you don't have $10,000 in your bank account right now, where is it going to come from? So start there.
A lot of people put it on credit cards, I'm afraid. You know, it's interesting. I don't think our parents would ever have had us if they had to have $10,000. Does that really?
It makes no economic sense whatsoever to have a child.
I mean, we would not have overpopulation as an issue by any stretch of the imagination.
No. And you make it work. I mean, you can make it work. But the thing is, and you know, every day is a new struggle, and you can kind of figure things out. But it's far better to have some sort of sense about what it's going to cost and get a plan together so it's not so much of a hardship. Because one thing for sure is that, especially if you're going through it with a partner, is that there's going to be arguments, a lot of them, because no two people think the same, especially when you're trying to raise a child and you've got financial issues at the same time, and it is a combustible problem. So it's very difficult.
All right, let's skip from childhood here to adulthood, David. Today, 25 to 35-year-old males make less when wages are adjusted for inflation than they did in 1974. People with a high school diploma make $12,000 less. Again, adjusted for inflation, they earn $30,000. With a college degree, they make $1,000 less, or $50,500. People are going to have to start boosting their incomes. Can they do that realistically, David?
Well, people can certainly do both things. They can manage their expenses and boost their incomes both. You know, in the 1950s, no young person in their 20s ever expected to be living on their own, even in a studio apartment. They were always renting a room from somebody else. And people can manage their expenses. Sharing living with friends is very common here in the Bay Area. And it is true that after adjustment for inflation, particularly for people who haven't got college education, that they're not making more money. But you can have a good life, and many people choose to have more than one job. So all of us here have a day job and an additional job. I teach at the university. I write a column for the newspaper. You're writing a book in your spare time. Now, in part, we're doing that to make the world a better place, but I also get paid for it. And so you can work hard and make more money.
You know, it seems as though costs keep going up, though. We were talking, again, in preparation for this, and we talked about how, at least for those people who own a house, sewer charges have doubled in the last year. They went up to $70, I think, at its base. A lot of things that you really don't have a lot of control over have become more expensive, and wages haven't quite risen that quickly. So I would like to ask each of you, if you had some advice, your top three picks, to help people in their 20s and 30s make the most of what they have and maybe make more, however you want to do it, please tell us. I think I'll start with Ramit.
I think that, above all, getting started is more important than anything. It's more important than the details. It's more important than these little pieces of minutia that we hear, like, should we have 45% or 48% stocks in our investment portfolio? Getting started is the most important thing. I think it's okay to make mistakes. I think that's critical for people to get started. It's okay to try certain things, because at this limited point, even if I lose 10% of my income, 20%, I'll, you know, cry a little bit, go home to mom, and that's fine, and I'll come back in 2 months. So I think that, above all, action matters. We can sit here and talk all day, but are you going to go open up that savings account? Are you going to go open up that investment account? That is more important than any number of books that we can all read.
Excellent. Erica?
The top three. The first one is trust your ability. I mean, it's amazing how many people doubt themselves, doubt that they will ever be able to pay their debt off, doubt that they could live without credit cards. And, you know, I mean, that's just, it's ridiculous. You can do it. It's entirely possible. And I find that very sad. Using credit to your advantage can also be done. You can make money using credit cards instead of having to pay it, but you've got to learn how. And then the third one is that if you do get into any kind of debt problems, you got to attack it early. If you don't, it's going to get worse. Get help. Don't procrastinate. You stick your head in the sand, and it's just going to be a nightmare. So,
Marjorie, how do you dig yourself out?
It sounds really basic, but I find this one piece of advice is what worked best for me, was setting priorities. Deciding what it is that I value the most and set all my financial goals toward that, both short-term and the medium-term and long-term. And that's for everything. It applies to your personal life, applies to your finances, applies to work.
And it's not just debt and paying it back. It's also saving. I mean, you make a very good point. You have those different timelines.
Exactly.
David.
I'd say these three things. I teach my students that your FICO score is more important than your GPA.
True.
Even if you teach people not to use credit card debt, everybody will get a mortgage at some point, and you'll pay much less over your lifetime for your mortgage and for car loans if you manage your credit score, and that's called your FICO score. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is, yes, you can have it all, just not by the end of this month. And so number one thing that we try to teach people is timing. And when people have grown up with credit cards, instead of thinking about, wow, next summer I'll work really hard and I'll buy myself – a new snowboard, people go out and charge the snowboard now and worry about paying it off later. So timing. And when a new baby arrives, yes, you have a tough year, but everybody gets through it. And maybe you don't take that Caribbean vacation this year, but timing, you can take it next year. And then the third thing is, it's pretty nice to have money in the bank, but there's actually nothing more valuable than the love of your family. And I think people never should forget that.
Thank you. You see, he's an excellent instructor. You could send your kids to Haas with no doubts. I'd like to add a few things to what you all have said, and you've said some really wonderful things. I would tell people to think. Just stop for 5 seconds or 3 seconds even. Do I really need this? Second, be aware of when you're being sold. Every day you hear about how you just want to whip your little card over this screen thing or have your cell phone be able to purchase something now. And everything, they've got these wonderful ways of just putting needles into your financial veins and sucking everything out of you. And so think, know when you're being sold. And you said something that you didn't say just now, and I'm going to use it. Know when to say, I can't afford it. He taught me that tonight. So those are the three things that I would offer.
Can I pile on to your, do I really need it? One of the things that I've taught my godchildren and family members who can't get away from me teaching them this is what I call the driving the Cadillac into work tomorrow standard. And my question I always ask is, what will I do materially different tomorrow? Now, there are some things that I've wanted, like for a long period of time, I really wanted a laptop. And there's all kinds of things that I can do with a laptop that I can't do with my computer at home. I also really wanted to have a Cadillac. And other than pulling up next to my boss in his Honda and impressing him, my life was not going to be materially different tomorrow. I'm just amused by this when family members say, I really wanted so-and-so, and then I applied your test of what would I actually do differently tomorrow. And you know what I'd do differently tomorrow is I'd get up at 5:45, I'd drive into work, and I'd hunt for parking. And nothing would be really different.
Erica, you have a little note you're making. No?
I did.
Oh, okay. I was just thinking,
and it just kind of hit me, is everyone's got a really different idea about what luxury is and about what necessity is and this type of thing. And for some reason, something that you said, I just remembered this, which was when I was in college and living really, really, really on nothing. I mean, just virtually nothing. My idea of luxury was to be able to go into a restaurant and order anything I wanted off that menu. And to this day, I go into restaurants and I'm amazed I could order anything I want. And to me, that's luxury to this day. And, you know, we all have different definitions, but sometimes there's this little moment that clicks in your head and you think, wow, okay.
I call it being grounded. Yeah. You know, I think that a lot of 20 and 30-year-olds have a lot of guilt thinking that they're not measuring up, that there's something they haven't done right. Now, we've kind of softly tried to deliver to you today some facts to let you know that it's not all your fault. Salaries and costs are a little bit out of whack right now. But what do you say to the person who just can't earn enough money to make it all the way to the end of the month? And that happens. That's when people turn to credit cards, I find. Any advice? I would say, David, obviously maybe a second job, but any advice about not making it to the end of the month?
You know, you can be running out of money before the end of the month on $100,000 a year. That's my answer to that. That you can feel poor on any amount of money. And there are people who make substantially less than we're able to make who have very good, rich lives.
Yeah. Does anyone else have a comment to that?
I think there's a fantastic book called Nickel and Dimed in which one of the authors goes undercover for a year and lives on minimum wage. Mm-hmm. She works as a maid.
Aaron Reich.
Yeah. And she works as a maid. She works at Walmart. And it's funny because we hear these stories about people who can't make it to the end of the month, and I always see other people commenting, saying, well, why don't they just get a better job? Or they can just interview. There's lots of places that pay $10 an hour. Look on Craigslist. And I think that's incredibly glib. I think that I don't have an answer for you, but to understand that there are deeper implications, like if you take time off work, you're fired, or you don't have a car. I think that those are serious questions that we haven't answered as a society.
I agree, and that's one of the reasons I asked that question. There are people who, if a child is sick, they have to decide, do I stay home with my child, mm-hmm. or do I go into work because I will lose my job? And so, Marjorie, you told us something that I felt was very poignant. I hope you'll forgive me, and that is that you'll be paying off your debt until you're 40. How does that make you feel? Does it leave you feeling hopeless, or do you have hope?
At first, I felt hopeless, but my attitude changed. I think of it more as a very large mortgage, and that allows me to deal with the amount of student loans that I have. But the point I want to comment on that Ramit made was, you could get a second job, you could find that better job, but for me personally, it was cutting costs. Goes back to the priorities. What is it that I want to spend my money on? And my time is more valuable. I don't want to get a second job. I'm making more money than my two parents combined now, and I'm struggling. I have to decide on what it is that is important to me.
Erica, when you work with people in consumer credit counseling, are they able to make those kinds of choices, the kind that Marjorie makes every day, or do they need guidance?
Well, everybody needs guidance at some stage.
Well, what kind of guidance
from it.
Do you give?
A budget. You got to sit down and look at all the numbers, see what's coming in, see what's going out, and then make some adjustments. And it, just to have somebody there, an objective person to say, well, you know, does this make sense? Does this not make sense? It's a wonderful thing to do. I wish everybody could sit through counseling sessions. And the reason is it's like sitting through family court. You know, it really shows you how difficult it is that people have it. And it may make you change your mind about how you deal with credit, to see the struggle that people are in when they're trying to repay debt, when they thought they couldn't really make it without it. You know, payday loans, unsecured loans, which are so expensive, doesn't make any sense. People turn to them when they think that they have to. Not always the case.
You know, in working on a project I'm working on, there is this issue of budget. And when I was younger and I approached a budget, I thought of it as a matter of record keeping, and I hated it because I had to be disciplined and sit there and write it in and make the categories and worry my head about it. And there were things I'd rather be doing, frankly. But I kind of had a change of heart. Now I see it as a game. Mm-hmm. I want more, so I'm going to give you less. I want to be able to feel secure and unworried. So I'm thinking that a budget is a stress buster. It's my stress busting game. I finally came to that conclusion. So when I know what's coming in and what's going out, and I have this little game in my head about I'm keeping more and giving the phone company less and this one less and that one less because I'm shopping smart and not going for the bells and whistles, I feel better. When you're finished with the people who've gone through counseling, emotionally, how are they feeling better? Do they feel in control?
Almost everybody does. Yeah, it's like, you know, this clouds part, and it's really bizarre. And even if the situation is kind of dire, you think, oh, well, at least I know what I'm dealing with, because I think the fear of the unknown is so horrifying. And almost everybody, you know, has a better FICO score than they think that they do. Almost everybody has some more options than they think that they do. It's when you're in financial straits, you're like a deer in headlights sometimes, and you think, oh, I can't see what's out there. And so just to have someone sort of like knocking on you and saying, it's okay, you could do this, you could do that, you've got some control here. So
Ramit said something earlier about taking action. All right, now you've polled a lot of your the comments from the bloggers and whatnot? And is it the taking of action, or is it actually seeing the money going into the bank or into their pockets or paying down the debt?
It's action. I have seen this from thousands of comments that I'll ask people. So one of the things I did a couple days ago, just yesterday, I asked people to tell me a story about their debt. I just said, tell me a story about your debt. I'm going to go speak on this panel. I'd love to hear. I got almost 30 single-spaced pages of comments from people.
I think there was 62 when I read it.
62 at the last count. And, I mean, the comments are just stunning. Some of the comments are, let me just read you one. I think about debt all the time. I currently allow myself $200 per month of money for personal expenses. The rest goes towards debt repayment and establishing an emergency fund. I do not enjoy the work I do, but at this point cannot see taking a lower-paying job. Overall, I'm pretty sad about this whole situation. Law school was insanely expensive, and to pay it off, I'm doing work that I do not find satisfying. It's very sad.
Very.
But at the same time, and very sad and very honest. I mean, there are dozens of these comments in here that make
but
you think.
But look how disciplined.
Absolutely.
That's incredible.
Absolutely, it's incredible. So there's also, I think, a lot of hope in these comments in that it's kind of like when you're in college and you have a huge essay or some project and you don't do it at all. And then once you get started, it becomes much more tractable. And the same thing, it can be, and I always push people, smallest step, tell me, go call up your bank and ask them, are you paying any fees? That's the smallest step you can take.
Right.
Open up a savings account. Do something as simple as you can, and it becomes much more tractable.
Right. David, I think you could address this well. The top 1% of U.S. households own more wealth than the entire 95% on the bottom. Is it an inevitable result of globalization, or can we change it? And by can we change it, I mean, is there a place anymore for public policy when it comes to personal finance?
Well, yes, there's a lot of public policy opportunities. I think what people from other countries in the world would see is that we have a culture where, as you know, we have a zero savings rate. And we have fancy cars, but we have a zero savings rate. So it's not so much public policy, but if the culture changed over time and people believed that savings was good, then I think that would help.
Can I add one thing?
Certainly.
I'm a big fan of paternalism for young people. I know maybe it's not the most popular word, but I think a lot of times what we don't need as young people is a million options given to us in 100 bullet points. What we need is someone to either tell us what to do, that's good advice, unbiased as much as possible, or better yet, do it for us. And let me give you an example. There's some great research out of the University of Chicago where if you have an opt-out policy for 401ks, you get much dramatically higher compliance for people actually doing it. So 401ks, when your employer is going to match it, there are billions of dollars left on the table because people don't go for the full match, which of course they should because it's literally free money.
And that's just what you're saying, because they don't even just fill out the form.
They don't fill
it's
out
just
the
an
form.
Action.
And that barrier is right. Enough. It's just filling out a form, but you'll get thousands of dollars a year potentially. And so what a lot of companies have started doing is saying, all right, we're going to by default withdraw 4 or 8% of your income, and if you want to opt out, then you have to fill out a form, which is great because it makes the laziness work the other way around.
That's right.
And so I think in those ways, paternalism can work really effectively.
Marjorie, you know, you have a lot of debt you're paying off. If you had someone paternalistically coming in and saying, I'm going to take a percentage of your income now, could you handle it?
It would be a struggle, but I would prefer that than the years it took me to come to the realization of what I needed to do.
Really?
Yes.
Erica.
We know that's what CCCS does. It's like you finally come to us and we're like, okay, we'll take care of it for you. And that's what people want. A lot of people want that. They want someone just to, you know, in fact, we have people coming in saying, well, can't you just do everything? Can't you pay, you know, can't you go into my checking account and write bills for PG&E? And this type of thing. I mean, really, you get...
They want a sugar daddy.
I know. But, I mean, yeah, I couldn't agree more, is that we lead busy lives. It's hard to find the time. And if we can pay someone or cajole someone into doing it for us, it's usually the most attractive option.
David, now the young people among us here are the ones who are saying we want a daddy to tell us what to do. You teach a class. What do your students, do they want to be have their hands held? Do they want a daddy?
Not at Berkeley, no. No, we select independent thinkers, that's for sure. You know, there's one country in the world that does that for people, and that's Singapore, and the government takes 10% of the salary and invests it for you. It's called the Central Provident Fund. And I think that would be very difficult to set up in America. But Ramit's right. The changing the option on 401ks materially changes participation rates, and so that's something that can be
different. I think it'll make a phenomenal difference. Also in Singapore, though, if you put gum on the floor, you end up in jail. Yes, it's a very paternalistic society. It's lovely and clean, but it's very paternalistic. If you were sending your little four-year-old off to college on her own into the dorm, knowing that she was going to graduate one day and become one of these 20 to 30-somethings who is worried about money, what would you want her to take with her to the dorm? What would you want her to know about money?
Yes. Financially?
Yes.
Good question. I kind of go back to that first one. Is remember that you've got the ability to say no. You've got the strength. You can live on Top Ramen for a month. You can do it. Well, you can do it. Look, the fact is that if people in Darfur can walk for 10 miles holding a cup, trying to get a cup of dirty water, and then return it back to their families under the scorching sun, you can live on potatoes. I mean, you can do it. But trust your ability to suffer through it. That's what I would like her to learn.
Do you think that I would like Ramit and Marjorie to comment on this. Do you think that among young people in their early 20s and 30s, that they're really capable of that kind of sacrifice? Or do you think that we're looking at the great divide, you know, kids who just blithely go their way and never think about the future, never think about any kind of sacrifice to get what they want down the road? Or is that an unreasonable expectation? Oh, don't just all jump in at once.
I would say it's so easy to have the appearance of wealth and the envy of the other, what everyone else has. You don't know. I mean, just because someone's dressed nicely, it's easy to get caught up on appearances. And I find living in San Francisco and that kind of environment, it's really difficult to, that's really too difficult.
You mean that the sacrifice is difficult?
Sacrifices. At least me and the people I know, it's really hard to get into that mode of making the sacrifice because you want to put it off. You want to deal with it later, not deal with it now. I find that I don't think they're willing, and I think that's the reason why you have, I mean, not only student loans but credit card debt in that combination.
Ramit.
I think my friends and the people that read my site, what I have found is not that they have necessarily the wrong ideas about money, but no ideas at all. So it's just a blank slate. It's let me not pay attention to this. Let me certainly not do a budget. Let me perhaps not even open up my credit card statement because I haven't done it for the last 9 months, and who knows what's on there. So. Sacrifice is a huge challenge. I mean, you're right. It is materialistic. It's easier to buy something than oftentimes not. It's easier to say yes to your friends and quietly deal with the bill later than to say, no, I can't afford it. That's an almost impossible thing. I've almost never heard my friends say that. But I don't know. I think that I've found for some of my friends who didn't care at all about money, there was something, there was some moment, some tipping point that brought them over to say, I got to pay attention to it. For one, it was having a child. For other people, it's just one day opening up and realizing they have $65,000 of debt. So I don't know what that is, but I think if we're there at the right time, like you talked about, then we can give them those resources.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll head into the question and answer part of tonight's program in just a few moments. What I'd like to ask you to do is please line up at the microphones if you have any questions so that we can take you quickly and easily through and get everybody in. All right, let's take one more question while people are lining up, and I hope they do. Is the squeeze that 30 and 20-year-olds are facing, Is the squeeze depriving society of the jobs that it really needs? By that I mean teachers, social workers, advocacy law, things that don't pay a lot of money. Do you think that the cost of student loans and credit card and appearances and whatever else is keeping people from going into fields that would help society at all? Do you see any of that? If you think I'm crazy, say so, please.
No, absolutely. When I went to college, I wanted to be an English teacher. And when I saw how much they made and the cost of living, it just didn't make sense. It, for me, I chose a business degree for undergrad rather than being an English teacher. And that's something that I can actually say actually changed the course I just decided to choose.
Ramit, is that...
Yeah, I've seen that dozens and dozens of times with my friends, people who have a passion for something, whether it's writing or any number of different things. And instead, they see what their friends are doing and they feel this sense that I'm graduating from this school. My parents paid a lot of money. My friends are making $80,000 their first year. What else can I do? I got to go get that banking job too.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Well, for the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're talking about generation debt. I'm Lynn Jimenez, KGO Radio's business reporter, and I'm here with consumer credit counselor Erica Sandberg, Inforum board advisory Marjorie Jellin, personal finance blogger Ramit Sethi, and UC Berkeley professor David Robinson. Now let's go to the audience for questions. If you would give us your first name, at least, so that we can address you, and your question, please.
Thanks, Lynn. I'm Noah Kagan. So I think, as Ramit said, a lot of people don't look at their credit card bill and they don't reach out to CCS or take the personal finance class. A lot of people avoid it. I'm working on personal finance education. How do you reach out to the people that don't care, that are very apathetic about their finances? You said, you know, they don't read blogs. Where do you reach those people at?
David, you want to try that?
I'll pass.
You'll pass. Ramit, I saw you leaning forward.
I think everybody cares because everybody has... Money matters. I mean, let's be honest. The question is, how do you reach them? And so I think there's ways to go directly. Let's sponsor a talk that they'll never come to. But better yet, let's go around the issue and go figure out, where do they talk? Are they talking to their friends? Well, what's more trustworthy than your friend saying, hey, man, can you really afford that $65 dinner? Or where is it that they're reading? Where are they hanging out? What message will resonate? And I think it's easy to take a lot of action, but instead the less sexy part but the more fruitful part is, let's do some research and understand these people.
I think also Ramit said earlier, before we came in for this presentation, that there are actually some corporations that do a good job of educating their customers and some that don't. As a business reporter, I'm very, very aware of who markets and who educates. I can't give names. I know Ramit has some names. But look at the kinds of places that give you very clear upfront information. I mean, if you say, how do I reach the people that I need to reach? Well, if you have someone that you know, you're trying to do this financial education, who one of these days wants to buy a house, why don't you ask them to go look and see if they can find 3 offers for a mortgage loan and tell you what those mortgage loans mean to them? Do they understand the difference? Or what about how much money they're going to make on what they're going to put into a bank or an internet bank? Or just what we did, what my friend did with her daughter. You know, how much do those shoes cost? I think if you bring it down to that level, day-to-day information, I think you'll find that they'll become much more interested. Did that help?
That did. It's also for, like, Eric, I'd like to hear your opinion, because you have people coming to your place. How do you reach out to those people to come in? I'm sorry if I'm taking out the time.
It's funny. CCCS doesn't advertise at all. We don't need to. I say that sort of, you know, jokingly, but the thing is that people do want help. They do. It's so scary and horrifying to not be able to pay your bills and to feel the stress every single day that it doesn't take that much. You know, we do a lot of, you know, these types of things, and it's really, we really do find that it's people come in droves. All you have to do is open up your credit card, see, not like what you see, and suddenly you'll just go, I'm going to have to do something.
I think, too, with what Erica is saying, people are coming to her for help, okay? Mm-hmm. If you're saying, I'm going to educate them, or here's a class, it's a different mindset. because they're not there because they have to be, because they're in trouble.
Yeah.
They're being educated. And there's some sort of resistance to being educated.
And there's a huge difference, because we definitely, I'm not a counselor anymore, I haven't been in years, but I certainly remember parents dragging their kids in by their ear and saying, listen to her. You listen to her.
And of course, the kids are.
And that's the last thing that they wanted. And so, yeah, it's got to be a willing participant.
Thank you for your question. Your name, please.
Hi there. My name's Kim Decker. And my question is kind of dealing with the question that you guys opened this up with, whether or not college education is worth it, given the amount of debt that people often find themselves in after. And that got me thinking, well, and as we've been talking about this whole time, that's two types of debt. There's like the student loan debt, and then there's a credit card debt that you accumulate.
Good point.
And I'm wondering if you could address the issue of good, and you sort of alluded to this, Erica, the good versus bad debt. Like, what does the debt have to show for it?
Yeah.
You know? So
Yeah, there's got to be some long-term purpose for the debt. So in other words, anything that you ate or wore
and or viewed. Or used your thumbs on.
You know, it just doesn't make sense. So, for instance, if you were to get into debt to start your own business, and, you know, that's a good use of debt. You're looking ahead. It's going to do something for you. School. I was an art history major. It's not like I was going to go out and, you know, become this world-famous curator. And I believe in debt for school. I absolutely do. It gives you so much. It's well beyond the income. So as long as there's a long-term purpose, mortgages, sometimes cars, although I'm not a huge advocate of borrowing a huge amount for cars, but consumer debt is really what we're talking here.
David made a point earlier when you said, you know, what's it going to bring you, when you were talking about the Cadillac versus the laptop.
Yeah.
If it's our standard would be, if you're taking on the debt for a productive asset and purchasing a house is a good investment. We think that almost all education is a good investment. Your second and third doctorate, it's a little iffy. You have to think about whether it's going to do anything for you. But then most of the rest of the stuff, if you can't pay it off at the end of the month, you don't need it.
Thank you.
Next question.
Okay, good evening. Thank you for being here tonight. I just want to say something before I present my question. One of the things that I find in this country, I'm an immigrant, I'm from South America, is that sometimes, as Meet mentioned earlier, people try to teach us what they think we need to know, but they don't do enough research to know what is it that we really know.
Good
so
point.
So just to make a bold statement, as Ms. Jimenez mentioned earlier, that Spanish-speaking people are that you're trying to teach right now, Spanish-speaking people are more about financial literacy. We have to ask ourselves that question. What is it that this particular immigrant group is looking for? For instance, Spanish is the second language spoken on the internet. So it may, as Ramit said in his blog, he may not find people that are speaking Spanish there in your blog, but guess what? They are bilingual, so they are able to access the website and, you know, write in English and everything. So I think one of the problems that we have in this country is exactly that. Just to reiterate, the financial education needs to be targeted, and you need to know what it is that you're teaching instead of thinking what they need.
Excellent. Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir, your question, please.
Hi, my name is Dave McClure, and I'm an entrepreneur and financeaholic, I guess I would say. keep coming back. I guess I've had personal experiences that I learned a lot of lessons from. Unfortunately, I felt like I had to make the mistakes first. So I went into debt in college. I went into debt buying a house. I went into debt starting a business. And I was fortunate, I guess, to kind of get out of those situations and sort of emerge stronger, if not necessarily more financially secure. But I used to work for PayPal, and one of the things that I sort of noticed was that a lot of people do part-time businesses, either on eBay or on their own website, to actually help add income. And I'm wondering, either at CCCS or Ramit, as part of your blogging strategies, most people go through trying to, like, track their finances and spend less. And obviously, I think that's probably the easiest thing. But do you give people any ways to look at getting out of debt by starting small businesses or part-time businesses so they can really you know, instead of having the painful thing of like cutting away, you right. know, is there something mm-hmm. I can do that makes me increase my income?
Ramit?
Yeah, it's really difficult to get people to cut costs. It's just telling the latte thing is, I don't even bother doing it because nobody listens. So I think, you know, there's some element. I mean, fundamentally, if you want to make more money, you either cut costs and or you make more money. You have higher revenue. So I talk a lot about entrepreneurship on my site and with, you know, my friends. Simple things like starting an eBay business is really common among the people that I'm writing for. And it doesn't have to be particularly glamorous. Sometimes people are happy to get $20 or $30 a month. And that, because that sets the stage for the next big step. So if I had to make, I try not to make a choice between cutting costs or making more money, but I would always go on the side of doing something entrepreneurial, because even if you fail, as you said, you're in a great financial position and you've learned a lot, and now for your next time, you know, you can probably do a very successful thing.
For people who feel burdened about by debt, there are some classic strategies, and I agree, most people find it very hard to cut back. By the way, bankruptcy is another strategy. We hope that most people don't have to face that. But the other options for people are to sell assets. You maybe don't need two cars. And then we've talked about entrepreneurial activities, but there are very many people who address this by getting a part-time job, whether it's working in a bar in the evenings or working retail on Saturday morning. And if you take a little part-time job and 100% of that paycheck goes to paying down debt, the debt goes down quite quickly, and it is extremely empowering. And by the way, while you're at the second job, you can't be spending money, so that helps as well.
See, that's probably the second benefit.
Erica, did you have something that you wanted to add?
Yeah, you know, for me, to help people make changes, you have to look at consequences and you have to look at rewards. Consequences of not doing it, you could get sued, which is really horrible. Increased anxiety, increased debt, and all of that. And then reward, hey, if you do make changes, your life is going to be so much better. And so if you focus on those two, you know, as far as what should you focus on, reducing expenses or increasing income, hey, it's like dieting. You might as well diet and exercise at the same time. You'll get your rewards a lot faster.
I totally agree. Yes, absolutely. Next, your name, please.
How's it going? My name's Alex, and I wanted to thank you all for being here. Very important topic. First quick question, what are some of the other books you all have read that addresses this issue? I've heard of one called Strapped by a Tamara Drought.
Another Excellent.
One actually called Generation
In fact,
Debt.
I was going to recommend it at the end.
But the other question, which I really hope we can address, is talking about the externalities of having debt in a younger generation. What's its effect on, say, involvement in the democratic process? I know more and more young people are getting involved with politics in this country, and I would argue that there's a huge correlation between debt and the involvement in the political process, and that's really dangerous given we've got a lot of problems on our hands, which we don't have to get into because obviously we're on Commonwealth Club and we know what they are, but... I just wondering if y'all could comment on that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Does any of the panelists have a comment on that?
I have a comment that somebody wrote. They said, in terms of your question about the democratic process and how debt sort of burdens us and distracts us, I'm 26 with $40,000 in student loans, this reader writes, and credit card debt, just starting to manage to chip away at it. It's awful having that weight. I feel like I have no freedom. With that $500 due every month, I can't afford to be without income for a second. So you can imagine how that affects our priorities.
You know, the book that he referred to is really quite good. As a beginning point, as a discussion starter, it talks about the fact that young people don't feel that their voices are heard in the political process, and that unless their voices are heard, that there will not be changes that concretely affect their financial standing, whether it has to do with reforming the student loan and or grant process, whether it has to do with changing or increasing to certain segments of society deductions for mortgages or earned income. It talks about a lot of things, and I do feel that the book is worth reading just to get the discussion started. You know, when people feel angry, whether it's of their own doing or someone else's, and I think many times more because it's of their own doing, their
not exactly going to be reasonable. You know, you're going to find anger and mobism and classism and all the isms you can imagine. And so these things are very important to our country, to the warp and woof of our nation, even though they're individual. Your name, please.
My name is Barb Johnson. I'm a mother of two under 30 graduates of UCs. And I want to ask the panel how you feel about having all these credit card companies, all these banks, there at the first day of school, which just amazed me, all lined up, giving out hats, all kinds of things to the kids, trying to get them to sign up with their company, explaining to them how they can borrow $400 from this card and you can borrow $300 from this and blah, 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 going on and on, and why the UCs permit these people on campus like that for these very young people who really don't know anything about money yet.
I would say, the panel will answer what their opinions are, but I would say that you should bring that question to the regents at UC, ma'am. I would love to hear their answer. That's a great question.
I said something to them when I went with my son, who was very upset with me. He didn't think I should say anything. But he was under 18, and he couldn't sign up for a credit card. And how do you expect these young people to pay for this debt that you're telling them to take on? They're going to school. Where are they getting the money?
Well, let's see what the panel says about
this. So I want to know how you feel about permitting this on campus, too. Thank you.
Well, I think this clearly may be an area where there are some public policy issues that could be addressed. And you've mentioned, in a sense, a micro issue, which is whether the state university system should allow money changers in the temple. And you've, in the last year, Congress has tightened up the minimum payment on credit cards.
Yes.
Because paying off a credit card was going to take 30 years. And I think that Congress might do well to tighten up credit cards issued to people who don't have the income to pay them off, and also to limit the credit card companies from issuing cards to people who already have high balances.
Now, Congress did pass the bankruptcy bill, but did not include any of the issues brought forward to solve some of those problems. They ignored it this time around. We have very little time. Do you have a short question?
Yes.
What's your name?
Hi. My name is Jackie Roberts.
Hi.
I have a daughter who's 23, graduated Cal Poly about 2 years ago, a year and a half. And I find that she deals really well with credit, and I wanted to tell what a friend of mine taught me when I was raising her, because I think it's so useful to people in the audience. When she became 13, I no longer gave her a typical allowance. I gave her all the money that she would need, and she had to buy everything.
Great.
So we went from the fact that she was buying couturier kind of things when I was paying the bills, and suddenly she didn't want to pay $24 for, you know, a pair of socks. I'm exaggerating, of course. But she all of a sudden went from these really expensive shops to Ross Vallès. And she still shops in Ross Vallès. And she manages it, and she looks great. She's a beautiful young woman. But she actually, I took an amount of money. I said, you have a choice. You can have 12 payments once a month or four or three, and I split the amount for her clothing on it. And I think it was the thing that empowered her the most.
I think that's an excellent procedure when the child is ready for it. And I think, thank you for sharing that. Do we have time for another question? One more question?
Hi, I have one question that wasn't addressed. One of the reasons I have severe credit card debt is because of medical issues. A lot of us, when you're in your 20s and 30s, originally your first couple jobs, you don't have medical offered, or it's not something you think about. And I ended up getting sick, and you end up paying a lot of money out. And it turned out that when I did get medical, it was still, I got it at a higher rate.
Welcome to the benefit-free zone.
Because it was a pre-existing condition, but they didn't know what it was.
Right.
You're paying.
So your question
tests.
Is?
Yeah. What do you do? Because, I mean, I accumulated thousands of dollars for medical debt, and I've had friends that have been in the same position.
Erica?
Yeah. Unfortunately, over just about 50% of all personal bankruptcies
are because of health-related issues, medical issues, just like that. And it forces people into bankruptcy. So it's not that I advocate that. It's just a fact of life. It happens. Now, what do you do if you don't want to file for bankruptcy? It's just the same as any other debt where you have to slowly chip it down.
Or negotiate.
Yes, you can certainly negotiate. And question every charge. I mean, there's problems that go on with medical billing.
It's a secret for you. Hospitals don't like to lose money. Doctors don't like to lose money. But they'd rather lose some than all. You get on the phone to each one of them and you tell them, I cannot possibly pay this whole bill. I'm young. I'm buried in medical debt. I need your cooperation. I want to pay you X amount. You have to figure 50% or 60% or whatever it is. And I'm ready. And have your payment plan in your own mind. That's where you get the leverage. Make a payment plan and present it to them and say, would you like it or not?
Well, what I did is I put it on my credit cards.
No.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
That's the last thing I do under those circumstances. You know, I want to leave you with something. I know that Ramit doesn't like the idea of trying to do the latte factor. You know, that's where you don't drink a lot of lattes. But I work at the NYSE, the options floor, and there are a lot of young guys around there, and I'm working on this project, as I mentioned, and I tested a couple of things out on them. And I found this actually got them to take action, Ramit, which is your favorite. So if you'll indulge me, I want you to understand that if you put away $167 a month in your 20s, with no effort at all, $167 a month, you're going to end up with at least $336,000 when you're 65. Now, that's not a huge amount of money, but figure, if you put nothing away, you'll have zero. Now, and here's what I want to tell you. It's easy to put the $167 away. You drink 12 fewer cans of soda or bottles of water a month, and you save $12. You put 50 cents in a jar a day, and you save $15. You order 20 regular coffees instead of cappuccinos a month. That's just 20 a month, and you save $40. You bring your lunch from home 3 times a week, and you save $60. Figure it out. It works. You drink fewer beers or cocktails at a bar a month, even if it's just 2 fewer a month, and you save $10. And for those of you with ATM and late charges and debit charges, if you really watch those, you can save up to $30. There's more if you eat out twice a month. 2 fewer times a month, you can save $30, and it goes on and on and on. So what I'm saying is there are real painless ways to save money that will at one point reach critical mass, and then go out and get that second job, and then you'll be rich just like Ramit says, right? Well, let's give a big hand to our speakers, Erica Sandberg, Marjorie Jellin, Ramit Sethi, and David Robinson for their thoughts tonight. And now, this meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, is adjourned. Thank you all for your patience and attention.
I was most proud of Walmart was getting behind raising the minimum wage. And it was sort of interesting that when they calculated, I was, you know, it sort of made sense. And I said, that's a good social position to take. And someone sort of murmured to me and said, it's not public, but we actually, it makes sense for us because we don't pay anyone minimum wage, but a lot of our customers make minimum wage or are affected by it. So it actually helps us to have higher wages. That's good. You know, I think that they should encourage the minimum wage to go up again. I think there are lots of strategies that it should be doing, and this is where CSR should be focused. So, I appreciate the question.
So this is the last question, but
I want to come back to your question, Adam, on that the market demands growth. Does that necessarily mean that in order for companies to grow, in order for our economy to grow, that we all need to be bigger consumers? I teach high school kids who are probably the biggest consumers in the country, and I'm trying to get them or inspire them to consume less. Should consuming less become a tenet of social capitalism?
I think so. And I love the compact fluorescent light bulb is a great story. It's really interesting because you sell one compact fluorescent in 5 years, and you're actually cannibalizing sales of 20, 25 incandescent light bulbs during that time. So you're actually having fewer sales, you're saving a lot of energy, and you're saving people a lot of money. There's a great campaign called 18seconds.org, which is a lot of retailers coming together with Yahoo to get, you know, basically to hit this goal of getting people to switch to that. I think we need successes in products that will help understand that. I think that the trend towards compaction in consumer products, or actually smaller Tide, is actually a good success story, because it's less, and saying that less is more, you'll save money, you'll save water, and it's good, even though it has oxy brighteners and there's problems. So I'm looking for behavioral trends that move us towards less, and to celebrate the small, and to understand, as Schumacher did, that small is beautiful.
So let's give a big hand for our panelists. There's so much to cover, and we just scratched the surface, but it really is an honor to stand here with four people who are on the forefront of this social capitalism movement, and also with an audience that takes these issues so seriously. While we haven't outlined all the solutions or identified all the problems, the commitment is very clear, and I'm very encouraged to be in the room with that. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum is adjourned.